case we'll hear argument in is Gloria Steinberg versus Janus Capital Management, LLC, et al. We are ready for argument. Mr. Matthews.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Tim Matthews from the law firm of Chimick, Lees & Tekelis on behalf of the plaintiff's appellants. This appeal concerns the mutual funds market timing scandal with which this Court is already familiar. In short, the Janus defendants allowed 12 hedge funds to make frequent in and out trades with the Janus mutual funds. They admit that these trades weren't permitted by the fund's prospectuses, and they admit that they never informed the fund's trustees, either at the time of their negotiations of advisory contracts or otherwise, about the agreements. The Janus defendants allowed these market timing agreements for one reason and one reason only, and that was to increase their own fees.
Greed?
Correct, Your Honor. There's no question in this appeal whether there was a violation of Section 36B. The district court denied the Janus defendants' motion for summary judgment on that issue, and the Janus defendants never cross-appealed. So the question whether there was a violation of 36B is simply not part of this appeal. The only questions here are what are the remedies for a violation of Section 36B, whether the plaintiffs have standing on behalf of all of the registered investment companies in which they held shares, and whether the Janus defendants are entitled to an offset for money paid pursuant to regulatory settlements.
It's really a pretty simple case. Either you're entitled to something more or you're not. So you've been covered by the settlement or not. Is that right?
I think that's right, Your Honor, except that we have argued that the Janus defendants are not entitled to any set-off for the amount of money paid to the mutual funds. And the reason for that is
Then the answer would be that you're entitled to something other than that.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
I think Judge Wynn has sort of encapsulated it, as I understand it. It seems to me, but you say he doesn't have it quite right.
The point I'd like to make is that if the court holds that the Janus defendants are entitled to zero offset, then we are entitled to something. And the question is, what is that something? Is it $800,000 in fees collected on timed assets? Is it the flight damages that resulted when investors withdrew their assets in droves and caused the mutual funds to incur portfolio transaction costs? Or is it the amount of the profit earned on the dishonestly negotiated and disloyally performed contracts?
What guides us as to what kind of damages are available? What kind of damages are available? I'm not talking about any set-off yet. I'm talking about what kind of damages are available.
Well, in this case, we've asked for two specific types of damages.
Yeah, I'm not talking about what you've asked for. I'm talking about what. What guidance do we have? What should be the standard of allowable damages?
Certainly. First of all, it's fiduciary duty law, plain and simple, which Congress incorporated into Section 36B by providing for a fiduciary duty with respect
Does
to
Does that not tend towards more of a disgorgement-type award?
That's correct, Your Honor. The fiduciary duty law would provide that the Janus defendant should disgorge the profits earned on dishonestly negotiated and disloyally performed contracts.
As to fees.
That's correct. The Janus defendants collected approximately $600 million in fees on these dishonestly negotiated and disloyally performed contracts.
But I thought your damages are limited to fees.
Those are fees, Your Honor. The $600 million were fees paid to the Janus investment advisor pursuant to these contracts. So of that $600 million in fees...
Yeah, but you weren't damaged as to that amount of fees.
Well, Your Honor...
I thought your argument is more like this. You may not accept it. Your argument is more like a certain amount of fees. By the way, I don't think we would get into the question of whether or not the actual fee arrangement, I'm talking about the percentage they charge as managers of the fund, that's the kind of stuff the courts have stayed away from. We can't get into that micromanaging that. But there was a certain amount of fees that they were entitled to, and I thought your argument is, but they took in $800,000 from people they acted improperly with, that is the amount that somehow that you shouldn't be deemed for, that at $800,000.
That's what the district court held, that the $800,000 additional amount was what the damages were. Our position, however, is that the $600 million contract that was negotiated, the contract for $600 million in fees, that was an agreement reached for loyal service. It was an agreement that was reached for honest and loyal service. And so The district court essentially wanted to pretend the market timing never happened. And if you pretend the market timing never happened, then what would the advisor have collected under the contract? $600 million. However, you can't go back and take away that disloyal performance. So the question that the court should ask is, what is the value of a disloyal fiduciary service? Now, we can't go out into the marketplace and find out what's the going rate for a disloyal and dishonest fiduciary services. So what the fiduciary law has come up with as the solution is that a dishonest and disloyal fiduciary is not entitled to retain a profit. And Section 47 of the Investment Company Act says essentially the same thing. It's under Section 36B insofar as it incorporates fiduciary law.
Section 47, I thought that had been dismissed by the district court.
Your Honor, what we did, initially we filed a standalone.
But I mean, hasn't that been dismissed? I mean, I thought you were talking about Section 36.
Correct. We brought a private right of action under Section 36B. We do not
47 claim action, that's not on the table, is it?
Well, we appealed as to the remedy under Section 47. That was from the very beginning when we filed our notice of appeal. The question of whether Section 47 provides a remedy here was part of the appeal. And so while we haven't argued whether there's a private right of action, and I would say that courts have come to different conclusions under that, but what we have argued here is that Section 47 provides a remedy. And it's essentially the same remedy that's provided under fiduciary duty law itself. What Section 47 says is that if a contract is dishonestly negotiated, you can't point to that contract and say, well, that was the value of the service provided. You have to set that contract aside. And that's what the Supreme Court said in Jones versus Harris. If the transaction doesn't bear the earmarks of an arm's length negotiation, you have to set it aside. And then you have to start over again. And here you have to ask, what's the value of a dishonest and disloyal fiduciary services? It's a difficult question to ask. And as I said, you can't go to the marketplace and determine what the true value of that disloyal service is. So fiduciary duty law provides the answer. And that is the dishonest and disloyal fiduciary is not entitled to retain a profit. It may seem a harsh remedy, but that's the one that the fiduciary duty law has come up with, because there's no better way to determine what a disloyal fiduciary is worth.
And do you get that by having to look at Section 47? Can you get it just by looking at the what arises under Section 36?
Yes, Your Honor, you can. You can easily just get there.
So maybe I'm getting confused. What is the connection with 47 and 36? Because I thought your claim was just under 36.
It is.
And the fact that 47 had already been dismissed by the district court, so I'm focusing on 36. And you're now passing 47 to 36. What is the connection?
You can get there either way. What Section 47
but
says.
But you can't get there if you didn't make a claim.
Well, we did. 47. We initially filed a claim, you know, in our complaint, one of the counts was Section 47. The district court dismissed that, essentially saying that, Section 47 only applies if the contract itself requires service that violates the Investment Company Act. And so that claim was dismissed. We haven't alleged on appeal that we can bring a standalone claim on behalf of under Section 47. What Section 47 says is that if the contract is dishonestly negotiated, it's unenforceable by either party. And so that means that the Janus defendants can't point to that contract and say, well, if we didn't allow market timing, that would have been the value of our services. They can't point to it because it's unenforceable by either party. For the same reason, we couldn't point to that contract and say, well, that's the value of services. Not that we would, but it's unenforceable by either party. So it's not that we have necessarily brought a claim under Section 47 to rescind this contract. Plaintiffs in other cases have tried that, and courts have pretty much always held that unless you have a claim under some other section, Section 47 does nothing. So what we are alleging here is that Section 47 is just a complement to Section 36B. The court can award disgorgement of profits under ordinary fiduciary duty law, Or Section 47 says if you want to figure out what the value of this fiduciary's services were worth, you can't point to the contract as the
so
value.
Section 36 includes remedies from other sections, is what you're saying.
I'm saying that it's really two sides of the same coin. Section 47, certainly Section 36B provides for its own remedies. But Section 47 provides a complementary remedy, just like Section 29B of the Securities Exchange Act.
And you can get there by going through Section 36.
Correct, Your Honor. And that's pretty universally accepted by courts that if you can prove a violation of another section which provides its own private right of action, such as 36B.
But under that theory, doesn't that eliminate the damages cap in 36?
No, Your Honor, because the damages cap under 36B is, 36B essentially says any award of damages shall be limited to actual damages
right.
from the breach and in no event shall exceed the amount of compensation received. The compensation received by the Janus defendants for just 1 year was $600 million. So if the court awards profits, a disgorgement of profits measure, then...
Does 36 specifically mention rescission?
Section 36B does not include the word rescission in it. What Section 36B refers to...
Wait. Do you get to rescission? 47 mentions rescission, correct?
Section 47 doesn't include the word rescission. It says that if the contract is dishonestly negotiated, it's not enforceable by either party.
Isn't that akin to rescission?
It is akin to rescission.
And then you get 47's potential rescission into 36 by the words other relief? Question.
Yes,
how,
exactly.
how do you get that 47 carried it into 36?
Exactly.
To other relief?
It's the other relief. And it's not just that, but Section 36B itself incorporates...
Well, then what would be the damages measure under rescission versus 36? You're reading 36B. Wouldn't it be the same thing?
It is the same thing. It's exactly
And doesn't that make sense that other relief must mean something else? If you get, then other relief would be same relief.
Other relief... In our case, what we have alleged is that...
But I'm saying if your claim that you read damages under 36 to be the total amount of fees, $610 million, that would be the relief then, $610 million. But if you read other relief to carry it in rescission from 47, the measure of damages there being $610 million, that's not other relief. That's the same relief, isn't it?
I think that's right in a way, Your Honor, although I would like to point out that we aren't seeking the entire $610 million. We're seeking disgorgement of profits.
I understand, but I'm talking about it, whatever the number is, it's the same relief under the rescission theory or your view of damages allowed under 36.
I think that's right. You can get there either way. It's either a disgorgement of profits directly under 36.
Well, doesn't that seem to do damage to the term other relief when, in fact, it is the same relief under your theory? Do you understand my question?
If you
read 47 carried it in because 47 gets carried it into 36 by way of 36 use of the word other relief, correct?
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
But if you carry that in, I think I've just tried to point out the measure of award to you would be the same relief. It wouldn't be other relief. It's the same relief, which would be damages in the amount of X, whatever you're claiming.
Let me phrase it another way, Your
okay.
Honor,
okay.
Which is that Section 36B, where there's dishonest negotiation and disloyal performance, under Jones versus Harris, you have to set aside the contract. And then we have to determine what were this fiduciary services really worth. What Section 47 says...
Well, counsel, excuse me. The court, in making its findings, as you refer to 36B, made the following finding in its opinion. I find that the $19 million should be considered to have come from the disengorgement, and Janus defendants are accordingly entitled to a $19 million offset in their liability to the seven Janus funds for these sections under 36B claims. The judge goes right to your argument there.
That's correct. The district judge granted the Janus defendants a $19 million offset. We believe that was incorrect under Sarbanes-Oxley and for the reasons stated in the brief. But even assuming the Janus defendants are entitled to a $19 million offset, that cannot fully offset the flight damages which are recoverable or disgorgement of the Janus defendants' profits.
Let me follow up at least in terms of the judge's questions regarding the import of Section 36B. I've been following this, your connection with rescission and 47 and how it all plays in. I don't think there's anything other, if you don't get this other relief in 36, you know, I don't know how you get there. But the MGDAL case seems to give us some guidance into just how narrow 36B is. And it says it pretty clearly, from what I understood, it, you know, deals with excessive compensation. And that's what you've got. Where's this case law that now brings in, as you say, you know, this is the way it's done, and I don't profess any great expertise in this area, so you're going to have to help me if it's the way it's done. But the MGDAL case must have not gotten it right.
They had
to have been wrong, because they said it's very narrow. This is very narrow what 36B is. It doesn't bring in all this other stuff that you're talking. So
the MGDAL case, Your Honor, was a very different type of case. It was a pure excessive fee case where the plaintiffs merely alleged that you were charging too much for the services.
It may be, but it does say very pointed. Section 36B is limited to cases where there was excessive compensation. That
correct.
Language is in there.
Correct, Your Honor. And what
so what we're in it, we're in, do, can I read from there, but there's a general practice you can now move over to rescission damages.
No, Your Honor. I think what we're talking about is really disgorgement of profits. And what MGDAL says is you have to look at the relationship between the services provided and the fee, the compensation. And so the question, again, boils down to what is the value of a disloyal and dishonest fiduciary service? It's a difficult question to answer. You can't go to the marketplace and find that answer. And that's why fiduciary duty law has supplied one resolution, which is a dishonest and disloyal fiduciary is not entitled to retain a profit. See, my time is up.
You reserve some time. Thank you very
Thank
much,
you,
Mr. Mayor. Mr. Terry, when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Judge Shedd, you started out by asking, what guides the courts in the allowable damages? Mr. Matthews gave us all a 20-minute treatise on general fiduciary duty law. Judge Wynn, you ended up with the MGDAL case. And the MGDAL case, I would submit, does supply the answer. The MGDAL case holds, in no uncertain terms, that Section 36B is not a general purpose fiduciary duty statute. That's Section 36A. There's a different provision of this very statute that provides a general fiduciary duty. That provision is enforceable only by the SEC.
What is the import of this no other relief language under the MGDAL case? I mean, it seems to be some tension in trying to understand, what does that mean?
Let me answer that in two ways. First, Your Honor, the other relief language is not an authorization. It is a prohibition. It says no damages or other relief may be awarded against anybody but the advisor. So it's not authorizing other relief. It's prohibiting the award of anything. What it means is, if you look at Section 44, the commission is authorized to seek an injunction in 36B cases. Private plaintiffs are not. Private plaintiffs are limited to monetary relief, and they are limited to monetary relief that is the excessive portion of the fee. That's the holding of the First Circuit in the Evangelist case, written by then-Judge Breyer. Very important decision that lays all this out in tremendous detail. We cited in our brief, Judge Shedd, at page 25.
He doesn't have that job any longer, does he?
He's got a different one now, and he joined the Supreme Court's decision in Jones versus Harris. And I point out, you know, Jones versus Harris, where does the court look to for 36B? Jones versus Harris, last term, the Supreme Court described this. The court cited two Court of Appeals cases, Gartenberg, which I'll talk about in a minute, and MGDAL, from this court. This court's leading precedent, Judge Wynn, you mentioned you hadn't read all the cases. You probably have. There's only about a handful of 36B cases in the Courts of Appeals. There's only three in the Supreme Court. One of them was MGDAL. The Supreme Court cited that with approval. These plaintiffs don't even cite it in either one of their briefs. It's this court's precedent, and it's dispositive of this case. What it says, correctly, is that the only monetary relief a private plaintiff can get under 36B is the excess portion of the fee and, what the Supreme Court said in Jones, the private plaintiff bears the burden of proof on what is the excess. They don't get a walk into court and say, your fees were $610 million, give them back. They have to prove what portion of that $610 million were excessive. Judge Motz held
in
this case.
Is there something to be read in there that maybe there's some other service that was provided that would entitle them to the other? In other words, maybe the plaintiffs got a benefit here and they shouldn't get back the fees that gave them that additional benefit.
Well, it's the plaintiff's burden of showing what harm, if any, came to the funds. And the standard for that is provided by the Gartenberg case that I just mentioned. The Gartenberg case lays out a six-factor test for evaluating advisory fees. The Supreme Court approved that test, that very test, in the Jones versus Harris case. It goes through things like the advisor manager's cost, the quality of the services, the profitability, collateral benefits, I think that goes to your question, Judge Wynn, comparative fee structures with other funds, and the independence of the board of directors. A court has to evaluate all those things. What did the plaintiffs offer in this case? On summary judgment, after full discovery and a full record, here's what Judge Motz ruled, and I'm going to quote from his opinion because this is important. Quote, plaintiffs have not presented any evidence that the fees charged by Janus were unreasonable when evaluated by industry standards. The Gartenberg analysis, which was adopted by the Supreme Court,
haven't courts shown a reluctance to get into very much of that micromanaging those? You might have a test for what they are, but courts have indicated a reluctance to be in the business of second-guessing and trying to manage and decide what reasonable fees are for a management company.
Absolutely.
Contrary to everybody's belief, maybe we don't know the exact number. But isn't that what courts do?
That
don't want to get into that.
It's a very important point, Judge Shedd. That's because the investment company, the mutual funds, are governed by a board of trustees that by statute is independent from the advisor. The Janus Board of Trustees, which is not in this room, is not represented here, Your Honor. These plaintiffs are trying to hijack the decision-making of that Board of Trustees. 36B, another reason, by the way.
Is there a limitation on damages in the language of 36B itself, in the language itself?
Yeah, there are two. There are several. One is it is limited to the receipt of compensation by the advisor so that the monetary relief can only be compensation received by the
advisor. How much was that in this case?
There was two answers to that.
Well, give me the right one.
$819,500.
Well,
that's the amount of compensation received from these traders that they're complaining about.
I didn't say no. You added from these traders complaining about it. I didn't add that. I just said the amount. Does it say that in there?
Your Honor, it does. I apologize. I jumped to my second answer without telling you I was going there.
Okay.
Or actual damages resulting from the breach.
That does not say that the fees from the parties themselves is my point. I'm not saying you're going to lose it.
I agree with that, Your Honor, and I apologize. I jumped a step without telling you.
Okay.
The important point about the received by the advisor is it excludes all these flight damages because they were not received by the advisor. They're entirely outside the statute before we ever start talking about numbers. The only thing the statute's concerned with is fees.
Right.
This court in McGill.
How much fees were received? More than $800,000.
$610 million from all the funds during this year. That is correct.
My point is, that's the way I thought you would go. I think that, because I know maybe you misunderstood my question. I knew well enough, no, and you're knowledgeable enough, you wouldn't try to mislead me. I'm asking, I believe that limitation may be appropriate, but that's sort of what I led off with. I want to understand why we should limit it. I don't see it in the statute itself. Do you see that in the statute itself, expressly, specifically?
The excessive portion.
What the number would be in this case. Says fees received.
Correct, Your Honor. The analysis would run this way. The outside number is $610 million,
correct,
because that's the total fees received.
Fees received, correct. Right.
Then we have to apply limitations.
Show me other limitations in the word of the statute itself that provides that limitation.
Yes, Your Honor. So, first, the plaintiff shall have the burden of proving a breach of fiduciary duty.
That has nothing to do with limitations on damages available.
It does, actually.
No, it doesn't.
Your Honor, because...
No, damages available. I'm talking about There are fees received. You just said that's $610
million. Yes, Your Honor.
But then there may be other things that, then there may be other limitations on that maximum amount, but that's not fees received limitation.
The maximum amount is $610 million.
Because those are fees received.
Correct.
But
and
now,
then we limit it by the other limitations in
okay,
the statute.
Okay, but are there aren't any other limitations that limit it to the potential available?
Oh.
Fees received, isn't that $610 million?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Now.
Okay.
Well, any award shall be limited to the actual damages resulting from the breach of fiduciary duty. And the reason then that
stop for a second.
Yes, Your Honor.
But I'm just walking. I'm not talking about the facts of this case, but how we apply it. So all 610 would be available under the right factual scenario.
If the plaintiff, this is the reason the plaintiff's burden of proof becomes important.
No. I'm not arguing that with you. I'm just saying under the right factual scenario, 610 would be available. You want to argue now it's not available in this case for a number of reasons, but I'm just talking about what's available under the language of the statute.
The
610.
The outer bounds is 610.
All right, what other limitation is there?
Actual damages resulting from the breach. The
right.
plaintiff bears the burden of proving the breach. This is a difference from general fiduciary duty law. Remember, under state law.
But I'm not arguing about any of that, because then we're going to go to what outside the language limits it. I'm just looking at the statute itself.
And I'm trying to get there, Your Honor. Actual damages resulting from the breach, the plaintiff has the burden of proving that breach.
Right.
Okay? Capped by two things. 1 year prior.
Right.
And you cannot exceed the compensation received by the security holder. It can't include investment earnings, lost opportunities, and things like that.
I think, as I read that statute, in this case, the potential is not 800,000, but the potential is 610 million.
Stated that way, I don't disagree with you.
Right. All right. So now the other limitations come from not any express limitation in the language. It may be the application of language in the statute to the facts in this case. Do you understand?
I understand, and I think I'm with you as well.
Okay, so my point is now I want you to tell me, since I started by saying I don't see an express limitation in the statute. It says fees received, which could be $610 million.
Yes, sir.
So now I want you to tell me how it is, and we apply this statute. In this case, there are, in fact, limitations.
Yes, Your Honor.
Burden of proof is one. I'm just asking, is there another theory on the type of damages that we should consider would be disgorgement type damages? I want you now to tell me, I don't see, and I think we're together on this, there's not explicit language in the language itself to limit. It doesn't say a cap of $1 million. It doesn't say anything like that. So now tell me what else would limit.
First, let me start by pointing out this is not, under state law fiduciary duty standards, if the plaintiff proves a breach, the defendant forfeits the fee and has to earn it back. The defendant then bears the burden of proving that it earned it. Okay, that's what Mr. Matthews was talking about. 36B, Congress quite deliberately flipped the burden of proof and says that the plaintiff has the burden of proving the breach, and the courts have held, the Evangelist Court from the First Circuit, for example, that the plaintiff has the burden of proving the amount of damages resulting from the breach, which is the actual language there, actual damages resulting from the breach, that that's the plaintiff's burden. The way the plaintiff has to carry that burden was established by the Supreme Court in Jones versus Harris, where the court said that the language of the statute, I think this goes to your point, Your Honor, is hardly pellucid, that's the language of the Supreme Court, but it has been given context over the last 20 years by the courts applying the Gartenberg case. The Gartenberg case provides the six-factor test, which I outlined earlier, which goes through profitability, services rendered, and so forth, in every step of which the plaintiff has the burden of showing the proof. So in other words, Janus gets to keep the $610 million, and the plaintiff tries to take pieces out of it as being excessive. And that's what Migdal says, by the way, as well. That's the holding of Migdal. So that the reversal of the burden of proof is absolutely critical because, and this is another important point, there's no demand requirement under 36B. When you mentioned, Judge Shedd, that courts don't get into second-guessing these advisory fees, in a normal fiduciary breach case, the plaintiff has to make demand on the Board of Governors, the Board of Trustees, the Board of Directors, whatever the governing body is, and only if that demand is excused or refused can they proceed to sue on behalf of the corporation. There is no demand in a 36B case, so it's a much narrower cause of action and a much narrower remedy.
You think that's in part because under 36A you have damages
under 30, Under 36A, you have damages, and also under Section 206 of the Investment Advisor.
The commission could invoke damages.
And the commission, of course, in this case, Your Honor, invoked 36A, 34B, 206 of the Advisors Act, 17D, the whole host of other remedial provisions that are available to the commission. There are also a whole other set, as Judge Shedd will remember, of other private plaintiffs who brought,
right.
There were 67 actions against Janus. They were consolidated by Judge Motz into five separate tracks. Everybody has been made whole.
You're right.
Judge
That's
Motz
what the Supreme Court got wrong in that case. But.
We could talk about that after.
Right. But the point is, and let me ask you this much, what do you think about the importing of rescission type, or of a rescission type damage, whether you call it rescission or not, through 36B? Do you think that undercuts the 36B carefully crafted cap?
The legislative compromise was to provide a monetary remedy only. Injunctive relief is left to the commission. All other equitable relief is left to the commission under Section 44. That's a very explicit provision. Section 47, you can't get those through other relief because other relief is a prohibition, not an authorization. But even on the plain terms...
By the way, I should note, when I said the Supreme Court had got it wrong, I'm just making light of the fact we've been here before with some other issues.
I hope to be here again, Your Honor, and we'll keep having these discussions.
No, I don't think you would hope you would not ever have to be here.
In a different case.
We're glad to see you when you come.
Section 47 on its own terms says...
Let me ask you this. I think I understand your argument there. That it appears to me you would say that would undercut the crafted limitation in 36B as to what is available.
That
then, under a rescission type award, you go back and all the money comes back to somebody, and you just say that's not how this was crafted with the rights of the commission versus private plaintiffs and all that.
And the burden of proof, correct.
But let me ask you, I'll let you continue.
The second line argument would be if you look at 47B itself, it says that the contract is unenforceable by the parties. These plaintiffs are not parties to that contract. The funds are parties to the contract.
Right.
They are permitted to be in this court only under 36B, but otherwise the Board of Trustees controls that contract, and the Board has to reaffirm that contract every year.
And you think do you think the amount of dollars actually at play would be the
$819,000. Correct.
If that's the case, now tell me why there's any settle or offset.
Well, the offset is in the settlement agreement with the SEC, Janus Capital Management.
Not just that it exists, but why it would cover the $819
sure.
in this case.
The deal was, or the settlement was $50 million in disgorgement and $50 million in penalties to pay first to the investors and second to the funds. The negotiation, and that was reflected in the final agreement, says that Janus can take an offset in this related civil litigation for $50 million of that, the disgorgement portion of that. In the investor class action, that is a class action brought by directly by investors in the funds, it was an overlapping group of investors who sued under 10b-5 and other statutes. The experts determined, and it was undisputed on summary judgment, that the losses to the investors were $21 million. Therefore, Judge Motz gave Janus a credit, applied $21 million against that $50 million as an offset. We then settled that case on non-monetary basis. That's a public because it was a class action, and that issue has been resolved. What in this case, when we got to summary judgment, first Judge Motz ruled that the only amount of fees that these plaintiffs had proved, had carried their burden of proving, were excessive under MGDAL was the $819,000, and that they hadn't even presented any evidence as to anything of that
$629,000.
Therefore, then second, that there was $29 million in offset unused, if you will, that hadn't been credited. And then third, the factual piece, the reason this came up on summary judgment, we presented evidence that out of the regulatory settlement, $19 million at that time had in fact been credited to the funds, to the funds that were affected by the trading at issue here. Judge Motz determined that $19 million was greater than $819,000, therefore the offset was total, therefore there was no recoverable losses under 36B.
Is that an alternative basis, or is that the final conclusion, the offset, I'm just asking? You think that the plaintiffs may well have shown $819,000 in damages. See, even if you were to concede that the real decision is, if we accept the offset, the case ends.
That's correct, Your Honor. I could tell you why I don't think there's even $819,000 in damages, but we can accept that given the offset because it doesn't matter, in other words. And under the plaintiff's view, you know, even they say we get $3 million, I think, so that's $800 less than that. So the offset does take care of the recoverable damages under Migdal, under Jones. I mean, to award what they're asking for, no court of appeals has ever approved rescission in a 36B case since the statute was enacted in 1970. No court of appeals, that's their rescission claim, so you'd have to be the first court to do that. No court of appeals has ever approved a measure of damages other than compensation.
Sometimes we like being number one.
Your Honor, me too, but sometimes innovation is not a good thing. You know, the flight damages claim, this court would not only have to be the first to award non-compensation damages, it would have to overrule Migdal.
Let me tell you this story. You might not want to hear it, but I'm going to tell you anyway. When I was on the district court, I had a rule about conspiracy, I think it was, in no reasonable foreseeability in a mail fraud case. And I ruled that way in a criminal case, and the lawyer stood up and said, Your Honor, I was getting ready to announce my ruling after argument. He said, Your Honor, you shouldn't rule that way. And I ruled against him. And he said, Your Honor, I just want to say no court in the country has ruled that way. And I said, well, one has. And fortunately, the Fourth Circuit said I was right. But, you know, it's always the first time. You make an argument that it shouldn't be the first time under the facts of this case and how it's presented.
On this case, though, Your Honor, it's not just the first court, but we have Migdal and Jones giving us very clear guidance on this narrow statute. And the plaintiffs really are asking to go beyond the text of the statute, the circuit precedent, the Supreme Court precedent, and frankly, you couldn't do what they're asking without running smack into Gartenberg from the Second Circuit and Evangelist from the First Circuit, you know, and creating a circuit conflict on the available remedies. You know, that's what they're asking you to do, and they're not acknowledging that, but I need to point that out, that it's not just doing something new, but it's doing something new in a way that would conflict with every available precedent. I'd like to end, Your Honor, to reiterate the point that 36B is narrow on purpose because it's not the only liability provision in the Securities Act. These mutual funds and the advisors are regulated by the 33 Act, the 34 Act, the 240 Acts. There's a host of liability provisions. Most of them are not enforceable by private plaintiffs, but that's Congress's decision, not the courts. And adhering to the congressional design here means affirming the decision of Judge Motz in the district court.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Matthews, you have some rebuttal time.
Thank you. Your Honors, first of all, Mr. Perry just said that no circuit court has ever awarded rescission under Section 36B, and that's incorrect. The Second Circuit did exactly that in Galfan versus Chestnut, another case brought on behalf of the funds under Section 36B and Section 47. And that was actually a very similar case to this one where the investment advisor dishonestly negotiated a new contract. And in that case, the Second Circuit rescinded that contract. So that statement was just not correct. I'd like to, if I may, say a few things about flight damages because that hasn't been discussed yet. Sure. And that's a very important part of this case. Regardless of what Your Honors do with respect to rescission or disgorgement of profits, we believe it's clear that flight damages are recoverable. Essentially what flight damages are, when the market timing scandal became public, investors learned that the Janus defendants had breached their fiduciary duties with respect to compensation.
Do we have to decide the question of flight damages if we think that if they were... Well, I guess you're going to have to because you claim you have some claim they're greater than that offset, don't you?
Yes, correct. So even if the Janus defendants are entitled to a $19 million offset, our flight damages
are greatly exceed that.
At least, yeah, $26 million to $28 million, depending on the standing question. These flight damages were essentially out-of-pocket costs that the funds incurred when investors withdrew their investments and the funds were forced to sell portfolio securities in order to cover those redemptions. So they are transaction costs, commissions, things like that, that were well out of the ordinary. The Janus defendants' SEC filings even acknowledged the link between flight damage and the market timing scandal, their memorandum to the Colorado Attorney
General. But how would that flight damage fit into, in no event, exceed the amount of compensation or payments received?
$26 million is well below $610 million.
No. No, as to what you've proved, you know, you don't think, coming from the same Section 36B, that language with the limitation I just went through with Mr. Perry, doesn't that limit it to that $819,000 you've shown in this case? Even if we were to, you understand my question, even if we were to say that maybe flight damages might be included, and I think you can make an argument that they can, as a technical matter, be included, but aren't they limited by the $819,000 in this case?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
And
tell me
why
not.
This is the reason. Section 36B does not say that recovery shall be limited to the excess portion of the fee. It would have been very easy for Congress to say that. Congress did not say that. Congress said damages are limited to actual damages and in any event shall not exceed the amount of compensation received. So the amount of compensation received, as was already established, was $610 million. There's no question that flight damages are actual damages. That's a term Congress has used over and over again, and it's always interpreted the same way, which is compensatory damages. These are out-of-pocket costs that would not have been incurred absent the market timing scandal. So it's really a very clear line. There's no ambiguity there. Congress did not say that your recovery is limited to the excess fee. Congress said you can recover actual damages. And let me give just an example of how that might occur in another instance. Let's assume that the investment advisor has 3 months left to go on their contract, and they say, we're not going to perform any more services. We give up. We're just not going to do anything. And the mutual funds have to go out and hire a new investment advisor, and so because they don't have any employees, they have to hire a consultant to do that. They pay the consultant $1 million. Under Section 36B, clearly they can recover the fees that they were paying their old investment advisor for 3 months. That investment advisor did nothing for 3 months and didn't earn that fee. But under the Janus defendant's position, the funds would be out the $1 million they just paid for a consultant to get a new investment advisor, because those aren't fees themselves that they paid to this investment advisor.
I don't necessarily buy that argument myself. I think they may well be included in the right situation, but you have to balance that off against the rest of what fees received and limitations and proof in this case. I don't disagree with, I would not say automatically that other damages cannot be considered.
Right. And so the question really becomes one of proximate cause. Were these flight damages caused by the breach of fiduciary duty with respect to compensation? We didn't get discovery on that. The district court deferred it. So to the extent there's a factual question there, I think we deserve discovery at a minimum.
Thank you very much. We're going to step down to Greek Council, and then we're going to take a very brief break before we go to the third case.